Radio and music, for me, are absolutely interlinked. My first memories of listening to the radio are tied up with hearing music being played live. When I was very young, probably about 3, my Saturdays were spent bouncing round Manchester in my father's minivan as he drove from church to church. This wasn't his day job, but at the weekends he'd become a wedding registrar, and, unbelievably, he'd take me with him. Apparently I'd just sit there at the back of the church, quietly taking it all in. My memories are of dark buildings, inside and out. Manchester's churches at the time were black with soot. In fact, I was surprised years later when they cleaned them up. I didn't realise they were sandy yellow. I just thought they were made of jet-black stone. Cars didn't come with radios either, but my father had managed to jam a transistor radio into the dashboard of the minivan, so we'd listen to lots of music as we went along. I heard songs like Eleanor Rigby for the first time on that wireless. In fact, whenever I hear that song now, I still see those dark satanic mills, the soot-black churches, with the rice where the wedding had been. I can smell them too, the waxy polish, the musty cold air inside them. I don't remember the wedding ceremonies at all, but I do recall being transfixed by 2 things. The stained glass windows, populated by morose-looking people with pale grey faces, and most of all, the music. I was bemused by it. Where was it coming from? I had no idea there was an organist playing an organ. It seemed to come from nowhere. I can feel it now, the sense of being immersed in that vast space, and it all suddenly being consumed by the music. I'd kind of forgotten that until one day I heard this music for the first time. Again, it was on the radio, but this time I was on the radio as well, early one morning, presenting The Breakfast Show on Radio 3, and I was caught off guard by this track. As soon as I heard it filling the studio, a profound feeling of connection swamped my mind. It's by Jean Mouton, a highly influential composer in his day. It's a Christmas antiphon by him, Nations Mater, written in northern France, where he lived and worked during the early Renaissance. He wouldn't have called it that, of course. He'd probably say he was working in a long-established tradition, a tradition steeped in a worldview of what we call the medieval era. And that's important here. I reckon it's music composed by someone with a late medieval mindset. It's an outlook we've lost touch with today, and I can't help feeling we should try to understand it a little more as we face one of the biggest challenges of our day. By the time I heard Mouton's music for the first time, I'd already started to piece these ideas together. The process began as I watched pictures being painted. This was when I was in my mid-20s, and I got to know a painter by the name of John Napper. He was a larger-than-life character, 50 years older than me, with a long career that had taken him from the Royal Academy schools in the 1930s to serve as a war artist in the Far East. In 1953, he'd been the first person to paint the Queen as the Queen, and he'd since lived and worked in Paris and New York. I met him when he was living out his last years in a quiet corner of the Welsh Marches, still painting every day. We'd talk as he painted. By then, vast but very delicate watercolour landscapes, often with a mythological theme, but specifically very carefully mapped out, just as his great hero Botticelli would have done. John explained to me how the scheme worked, why it was so significant. He died in 2001, but the very last thing he was commissioned to do was create a stained glass window for the Chapel Royal at St James's Palace. It's huge. It fills the entire north end of the chapel above the altar and depicts a rosebush climbing out of the royal cipher with birds and other creatures perched on its branches and with a large yellow sun beaming down from the sky. And once again, he mapped it out very carefully. But as he'd never made stained glass windows before, John had me drive him from church to church to study the process. And it was a fabulous education, because I started to see that this scheme of his, the scheme that Botticelli had used, was also the scheme that underlies the structure of so many churches and cathedrals, or indeed buildings in every other sacred tradition. It all fell properly into place for me in Lincoln Cathedral as we studied the two magnificent rose windows there, the bishop's eye and the dean's eye. John had a rich and booming voice, and he was never put off by people staring at him. And people certainly stared that day, because there we were, in a Christian cathedral, with John loudly extolling the virtues of Islamic art, how the geometry of the rose window came from Islamic patterning, and particularly from the circle, the universal symbol of wholeness or unity, which, as he explained, is made up of two elements, the line and the point. We tend to notice the line, John told me, but it's the point that's fundamental. It's the essence of the circle, the origin of everything. Since then, I've studied Islamic patterning, and it's true. Using just a pair of compasses and a ruler, you quickly discover that the circle contains all the other shapes in geometry. And if you know what you're doing, those two tools can create the sorts of patterns that decorate something as complex and as beautiful as the Alhambra Palace in Granada in southern Spain. Although it's far more than decoration. This is patterning that's loaded with symbolism. And it's no more Islamic than it is Christian. It goes right back to pre-Christian Greece, when Plato defined it. Plato holds that the very centre of the circle represents the uncreated. From that uncreated centre comes the line, the manifest world. John explained to me that placing the compass point on the circumference of a circle and drawing a second one represents, in Platonic thought, the emergence of duality. And as soon as you draw that circle, where the two overlap, you get a third shape. It looks like a fat rugby ball, and you see two of them side by side in the bishop's eye window. This shape, for Plato, symbolised the relationship or ratio between the one and the other. Draw a line that divides that third shape in half, and you get the Gothic arch. And if you draw two straight lines from the end of that dividing line up to the top, then you have an equilateral triangle, the Christian symbol of the Trinity. But for Plato, it was the symbol of balance and harmony in life. But do not forget the point, said John. Notice how the window is so full of life. It's an endless cycle of change. But your eye keeps being drawn back to that still centre. It's all anchored by that point, which is, as Plato says, unchanging. As we left Lincoln Cathedral, I asked John where he thought all this geometry and its symbolism came from. Where did Plato pick it up? He smiled and picked a daisy from the grass verge, handed it to me and said simply, "It's all there." It rather blew my mind, this, when I first saw it. But the geometry of those rose windows and the precise geometrical relationships that map out the entire cathedral are actually a reflection of the principles that govern the patterns of growth in nature. It was Islamic scholars who first salvaged Plato's writings from the ruins of the ancient world, and at the height of the golden age of Islam in the 10th century, you find scholars like Abu Nasr al-Farabi fusing Plato into Islamic theology. Al-Farabi spoke of the beauty of a work of art, putting us in touch with our inner metaphysical reality, of art marrying the material to the immaterial. So we experience what Islam calls tawhid, a word meaning unity. Tawhid is one of the seven principles of Islamic architecture. These ideas were then scooped up by Christian scholars visiting the great centres of Islamic learning like Cordoba in southern Spain, and some of them went home to establish the schools and foundations that built the cathedrals in northern Europe, which is why Thomas Aquinas talks of each part of such buildings articulating the whole in its unique fashion, so that in the fabric of the whole the divine can reveal itself most fully. This is the medieval mindset I mean. The one that underpins Mouton's music, music which matches the space for which it was written. It's an attitude that saw the manifest world as revealing the divine. Divinity in the medieval mind wasn't something separate. The creator wasn't out there. It was the inner source of the manifest world, just as the point is the source of all that fills the circle. So in this medieval outlook, to stand in the midst of a structure like the astonishing Gothic cathedral in Amiens, where Mouton was in charge of the choir, and which is still the biggest church in France, was to stand within a concrete expression of what medieval scholars referred to as the world soul. Not to observe it like a tourist, but to be participant in it. And that's the feeling I get when I hear Mouton's music. As Mouton was composing it, the fruits of this outlook were also appearing in Florence, where the Medici employed many fine artists, Botticelli chief among them, and where Marsilio Ficino made translations of all of Plato's work. And with his book, The Theology of Plato, he did what those Islamic scholars had done before him, this time fusing Platonic principles with Christian theology. It's all there in Botticelli's most famous painting, La Primavera, his portrait of spring. But it's also a portrait of another great reawakening, the rediscovery of those timeless principles which Ficino, through Plato, saw at work everywhere in the natural world. As he put it, there will be some who observe that there is life in the lowest animals and the smallest plants, but they don't see that the whole, in which we live and think and have our being, is itself alive. What I hear in Mouton's music is this perception. It's an expression of wholeness, and I think that's an important principle, not in a religious sense, but as Ficino observed, because it's how nature works. I've long felt we've somehow managed to persuade ourselves we can opt out of nature, become distant observers and manipulate it without cost. Of course, lately, doubt has started to creep in. I suppose it concentrates the mind when you see the Arctic permafrost on fire or the oceans filling up with microplastics. So perhaps it's worth reconsidering Plato and Ficino's perspective. We can't opt out. We're deeply immersed in the natural world, and not as separate entities either. We are its web of connections. We now know that a tree isn't a distinct thing, but it's connected to every other tree around it, and rooted in a billion microbes in the soil, without which it cannot be. And we're the same. We can't be without the millions of bacteria inside us, consuming our food to keep us going. It's quite a shift in our modern outlook to appreciate this ancient perspective completely, but I find music like Mouton's helps me make the shift every time I hear it. It conveys a deep-seated sense of participation in the living universe. And consider that word, universe. It's surely closely related to Tawhid. His music suggests an architecture that consumes me, just as I felt, quite instinctively, the space and music of those Mancunian churches did all those years ago. So, for me, Mouton's music is a prayer to that one verse, sung by nature, in which, as Marsilio Ficino put it, we live and think and have our being.